Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of July. We have two big stories to cover this morning from the Middle East. We will look at the top of the show at what's happening in Iran. They test-fired more long-range missiles overnight. This is a second round of exercises showing the country can defend itself against any attack by the United States or Israel. This was reported by State Television in Tehran. The weapons have special capabilities, and they include missiles launched from naval ships in the Persian Gulf, along with torpedoes and surface-to-surface missiles. This was according to the broadcast with no elaboration. Also, we will talk about Afghanistan. Our guest has written several books on Afghanistan. This week, a suicide bomb attack on the Indian embassy in the Afghan capital. And according to the interior minister of Afghanistan, the people who did the bombing received their training at camps in Pakistan. And then there is news today that Pakistan, that particularly wild region on the border with Afghanistan, has become the new training ground for militants from many parts of the world. So we're going to look at all of these issues this hour, and our guest is David Isby. David is the author of three books on Afghanistan: War in a Distant Country, Afghanistan Invasion and Resistance, War in Afghanistan, the Soviet Empire at High Tide, Russia's War in Afghanistan. He has been a former specialist correspondent with Jane's Intelligence Review. He's a familiar person with many of the key players in Afghanistan, a member of the board of directors of the Committee for a Free Afghanistan. He's a Washington-based attorney, has provided policy support for U.S. government negotiations, testified before congressional committees as an independent expert on Afghanistan, and is a former congressional staff and with Washington-based think tanks. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about both Iran and Afghanistan this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, for you to join our conversation. David Isby, hello. Thanks very much being with us. Before we go to Afghanistan, let's go to Iran, where they fired more long-range missiles overnight. Why are they doing this? Just to show their strength, and what could the possible response be on the part of the United States and on the part of Israel?
Well, certainly missile diplomacy is a very big part of the world. This has been seen in years of reciprocal testing with India and Pakistan. The Iranians have, even before this, fired off missiles to show their capability over the past years, and with the increasing tension over their nuclear program, I think this is they are trying to very much show a sign that they are not going to be deterred, and they are going to continue developments, including missiles which don't make a lot of sense unless you have weapons of mass destruction to put in them.
Mm-hmm. They keep saying that, of course, they're not doing nuclear weapons. They're using this for their energy needs.
Certainly it would, but the question being, if you're people building a large missile capable of reaching targets in Israel or Europe, and unless you put a weapon of mass destruction in it, it's just a very expensive way of delivering a ton of explosives without great accuracy.
Everybody's getting a little nervous about what may happen in the next few months here. Israel's maneuvers, the United States talk about anything is on the table. What do you think is on the table in response to this?
Certainly the Iranians, for both international and the domestic interest, just didn't want to show they were being coerced, and they certainly have enough money with the recent energy crises to continue this commitment to nuclear weapons development, which goes back many years.
What do you think the proper course of action to keep the country from developing nuclear weapons should be on the part of the United States? Is it time to strike the country?
Well, that would be very difficult, and certainly get you the possibility of a broader conflict. Mm-hmm. It certainly has been held up as a policy option. It's just the Iranians have had the very bitter lessons of watching both the Iraqis and now the Syrians have their programs preempted. So it's largely suspected that they have gone underground. They have dispersed it in such a way that it would be very hard with a limited nuclear limited attack on the nuclear program to remove the entire cancer at one go.
One of the presidential candidates, Barack Obama, has talked about negotiation. It has been a big part of his campaign. Is negotiation possible here, and with whom would you negotiate?
Well, that's the point of the in the end, what could you offer? The difficult thing is in Iran, even the quote-unquote good guys, people who aren't for destroying Israel and hold the religious conservative head of state in unfavorably, even they sort of like nuclear weapons. You know, they will tell you that, look, we live in a dangerous neighborhood. People like Israel and Pakistan already have nuclear weapons, and after the Iraqis used chemical warfare on us in the Iran-Iraq war, the world community didn't do a whole lot. So, yeah, we kind of like it. So that's the difficult thing. Even if you do negotiate, you'd have to offer a security arrangement to the Iranians in which they can get their national security assured in ways other than having nuclear weapons, which is very hard to envision how that could work.
Considering the fact that Israel has already made some movements in the past couple weeks and that Iran is doing a second round of test firing of missiles, I would imagine that Israel is a little bit nervous today about what's going on. What do you think, and I guess would they be in touch with the United States, what would their response be to this? To move ahead with perhaps a strike on their own or with the United States' approval or what?
Oh, well, it's hard it is certainly hard to say, and the Israelis are always reserve the right to make their own national security decisions, and it's with or without consulting the United States. The question being not so much could they do a strike against Iranian facilities, which they probably are capable of. It would be the difficulty in sustaining this over time, and especially if they do not destroy the program and that reconstitutes itself. We saw how difficult it was to predict what's actually going on with the whole sad story of Iraqi WMD, whereas in 1991 we found they were more advanced than we imagined, and then in 2003 there was, of course, no WMD program ongoing. So it's just so hard, unless you have some sort of crown jewels such as excellent intelligence, it's so hard to actually envision what you have to strike and remove to take away someone's capability.
Right. And what kind of intelligence do we have? Do we have anything approaching excellent intelligence?
Well, the excellent intelligence is only excellent if the other guy doesn't know you
right.
have it. Sometimes you find out, years afterwards that such and such communications were being decrypted, or that a such and such a chief scientist was actually sending in reliable human reports. So, or then the question being, even if you are getting these things, what if the bad guys have found this out and are feeding you bad information?
Mm-hmm.
It's so very hard to say, and this is where the intelligence game is being played for very high stakes indeed.
Right. Considering the intelligence that was so faulty coming out of Iraq, is everybody extraordinarily cautious about making sure that they do have correct intelligence when it comes to Iran?
It is, and also just the sheer difficulty of what it can tell you, and being cautious is not the answer. It's just having an awareness of what intelligence can tell you and what it can't.
Let's go to our audience. Can do Iran or Afghanistan, take on the whole area if you would like this hour. But it's also been a big week and a tragic week in Afghanistan. Tell me about this attack on the Indian embassy in the Afghan capital. And evidently, according to the interior minister of Afghanistan, the militants who carried this out were trained at camps in Pakistan.
Certainly. I mean, the vast majority of these terrorist-type attacks, which followed earlier this year the attempted assassination of President Karzai, and indeed most of the insurgency down south, is largely cross-border. Many of the people are supported in this terrorist from the resurgent Al-Qaeda and its associated groups. So you have a number of distinct wars going on in the same time and place, but all coming from the Pakistani side of the Durand Line.
And today's New York Times, I talked about at the top of the hour, said there's been an increase in the number of foreign fighters who have come to these areas. They're coming from Sunni extremists from the Middle East, from North Africa, and from Central Asia.
Yeah, it has become very much that's the Al-Qaeda has an appeal, and between that, everyone really with a grudge between Morocco and Mindanao, this is where they are heading right now. And most of them, fortunately, are relatively low levels of skills and may end up just carrying a Kalashnikov in South Afghanistan and trying to kill U.S., Canadian, or NATO troops. On the other hand, some may become more dangerous terrorists. Beitullah Massoud, the Waziri tribal leader, who is a strong ally of these groups, he's said to control very large numbers of potential suicide bombers, mainly recruited from these groups.
And tell me, what is the difficulty in rooting out some of these groups? Is Pakistan dropping the ball? Is the United States not as involved? I mean, how can we be at a point so many years after September 11 that these groups are growing in Pakistan?
Well, these groups have grown in Pakistan. The U.S., certainly, the focus not so much on bin Laden and the old original Al-Qaeda, while the original Al-Qaeda organization, except for bin Laden himself, has been largely destroyed or seriously damaged. What has grown back is a different organization with different personnel. Many of the older Arab leadership, as many of them have been killed or captured, have been replaced by newer Pakistani leaders. So it is a changing threat, and also it's been able to plug itself into a network that pre-existed them, that was created in part by the Pakistani intelligence to support the wars in Afghanistan and Kashmir. So they have found on the Pakistani side of the Durand Line, the vortex of terrorism, which, curiously enough, is the title of my next book.
Oh, really? And what about India's response to this? There have been calls for India to be much more militarily involved in Afghanistan.
Well, that certainly has been. That is, of course, the great Pakistani nightmare dating back to the 1970s. That Indian divisions will somehow show up in Afghanistan, or Indians will control the government, and they will be encircled. And in recent years, when India is becoming sort of wealthy and internationally accepted, and they're not, this has become much more of a paranoid, more than just a paranoid fear. The Indians do want a good relationship with Afghanistan. This goes back many centuries, indeed, even to the early years of Indian independence. One of the reasons why Pakistan has these links with the terrorist and insurgent groups in the Pakistani borderland is that they feel that having an insurgency of people they control is the only alternative to when the Americans go home and NATO goes home, the Indians filling the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And that is their great fear, that the Americans are going to leave, the Europeans are going to leave, and the Indians will show up, or someone else they don't like.
We're going to welcome phone calls for David, and we'll take them in just a moment. David Isby is our guest. He's the author of several books on Afghanistan and one forthcoming, War in a Distant Country, Afghanistan Invasion and Resistance, War in Afghanistan, the Soviet Empire at High Tide, Russia's War in Afghanistan. He's written a number of articles on national security. He is a familiar person with many of the key players in Afghanistan, a Washington-based attorney and consultant on national security issues. We also can take on, as we did the first part of this program, what's going on with Iran firing another round of missiles, testing another round. And we're looking at Afghanistan and Pakistan and India and increased violence in that part of the world. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Michael Dobbs will be with us. Michael is the author of a wonderful book. It's just, all this information that I never knew about, some interesting and breaking news information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The book is 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. And Michael will be with us hour two of our show today. All right, we have a lot of phone calls coming in for David Isby, 800-486-8655. We start with Adam from Presque Isle. Hi, Adam.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for having the show. I admit to being a retired historian. The question I have to your guest is more a statement and looking for a response. If you start with the U.S. government's, Defense Department's excellent country studies, for example, on Afghanistan and Pakistan, or any of the other standard works, you find that neither Afghanistan nor Pakistan are really nation states. In fact, you could call them failed states. I personally am most reminded of Poland in the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s before its division by Prussia, Russia, and Austria. You have too many profound ethnic and religious splits. The Durand line that the British imposed, in fact, cut right through the heart of the Pashtun area and took off parts of what is Baluchistan and so on. You've never had a stable government in Pakistan since its foundation. Afghanistan only survived as a weak Polish-like republic because the central monarchy basically agreed to sit as a mediator on top of a whole pile of contending forces. I don't see how anyone can defend or justify major U.S. intervention in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, aside for limited police action to hunt down the terrorists of Al-Qaeda. I'd like to hear how you can defend major U.S. Continued presence and action in both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Okay, thank you, Adam, for your call. David?
Listen on the radio.
Well, the point of Afghanistan, well, certainly is not the former Yugoslavia. And the interesting thing, while it is ethnically divided and has more divisions than in geopolitical, in ethno-linguistic, religious, racial ways, then you could discuss briefly. The interesting thing is no Afghan actually wants to end Afghanistan and break it up and join the other countries. The countries are there because if the only reason is the people who want to live there want to be part of it. And for the Afghans, yes. For Pakistan, it's a harder question. There is a longer crisis of government. But the Afghans didn't make Afghanistan fail. It was the war that made Afghanistan fail. The Pakistanis certainly have had a much longer crisis, and that's unfortunately, because of its cross-border nature, you're going to have to deal with the Pakistani issues before Afghanistan can have a lasting peace.
Thanks so much for your call. Ron from Madison is next. Hi, Ron.
Aren't Israel and the U.S. much more dangerous to world peace than the countries you've been discussing? In 1981, U.S. bombed Iraq, what they called a nuclear site. Just last September, they bombed Israel. In both cases, they used warplanes built in the U.S. and bought with U.S. Foreign military aid. Israel is known to have between 100 and 200 nuclear weapons. That's more than India and Pakistan combined. If you add up all the nuclear weapons of Iran, Iraq, and Syria, the grand total is zero. The spy agencies, the intelligence groups know that. They've told us that repeatedly, but the government still wants to attack. The U.S. has somewhere around 8,000 to 10,000 nuclear weapons ready to go. You might be able to give us a more precise figure. We have about 800 land-based missiles from Montana to Nebraska with nuclear weapons on board. There are hundreds more nuclear missiles on submarines, which can be parked just a few miles off the coast of any country with an ocean coast. I mentioned the two Israeli raids. The much more significant nuclear attacks were on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where somewhere between 90 and 95% of the human population killed and injured were civilians, not military. Both of those were carried out by the U.S. military government. Aren't we a much greater threat to world peace than Iran or Iraq or Pakistan or Syria?
Certainly the thing which makes the Iranian potential nuclear threat particularly worrisome, and this is why we have the current issued actions by the United Nations Security Council, the Europeans, the U.S., and the Israelis, is that the Iranians are fairly well outside the norms of international behavior on these issues. They have, you know, not just things like state sponsoring of terrorism, the threats to the existence of Israel, and they have over the years been willing to shoot missiles at other countries, the UAE, Iraq before the U.S. 2003 invasion. So certainly it's having this very much with Iran, and you know, for a country which tries to keep an ideology of martyrdom and Islamic revolution, one cannot assume that the mechanics of deterrence, in which one nuclear power keeps the other at bay, is going to work there in the future. So this is why people are worried to an idea where people are worried about, yes, Iranian nuclear weapons, where people aren't worried about British, French, or American, or Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a broad question here, because it seems as though we've been at this for a long period of time. We have been at it for a long period of time. We've had 7 years of war, billions of dollars to support the government of President Karzai, and the news reports we're getting now is that the situation is much worse. And so we're going to obviously be involved. The next administration will have to perhaps send more troops to Afghanistan. Why does it keep getting worse? This is a fairly long period of time to be at this.
Well, it's very hard. You know, numbers can show a lot of things, largely because it's a cross-border insurgency. The numbers going up means the people on the other side of the border are pushing harder. They are devoting more resources. Whether our policies have been effective, which in large part they have not, is really not so much shown by the figures. So you have to be very, you know, it's the old joke, you know, numbers will confess anything if you torture them long enough, and you don't even have to torture these numbers to realize that just looking at this are misleading. This was the great thing in Vietnam where they did a much more sophisticated look at the numbers to determine which way that conflict was heading, and that proved to be misleading. So I think it shows that the people in Pakistan have the resources and are willing to fight the conflict. And these are the same people who brought you in different ways, not only 9/11, but this most recent bombing at the Indian Embassy.
Thanks, Ron, very much for the call. Jim is next from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hello.
I guess in the direction of that, you know, of Iran, Is there any information at all that says that the nuclear research and production is not in the direction of power plants? And is there something that's being done specifically that would be only used for weapons? The possibility that that the launch of the missile was pretty much to as a scare tactic for Israel, and in the process, everybody gets scared, even provoked into doing something, and then we look as stupid as we were in Iraq when the intelligence turned out that that they didn't have anything. And so I'm just wondering whether are we looking at psychological reasons for firing the missile, and that the research is actually for power plants? Because if it is, then they're not exactly breaking any laws or any agreements. If they are going into missile research, then they would be, right?
Well, certainly, yes. Psychological, I mean, this gamesmanship is very important. I mean, you have only to see the, and this is certainly not the first time the Iranians have fired off large numbers of missiles in a day. Indeed, they fired them at Iraq in peacetime and in war. So, yes, the psychological aspects and deterrence and threatening to Israel or the United States are very important indeed. As for the nuclear program, the concerns have been there with the IAEA that the, have been basically not so much that a military program, but that the civil program is really intended to produce material that could then go on to be used to make weapons. So yeah, even though the program does indeed, present itself as civil, there is the idea that what the United States, the Europeans, the Israelis are concerned of is largely what flows from the civil program.
And thanks very much for your call. Here's an email that's come in, Jim from Madison. Any Euro-Christian presence will never be accepted by the natives of Afghanistan. They have a rich history of having defeated the British, the Soviets, and now the Westerners. As poor as the Afghans are, they're even more determined to defeat the great Satan. I believe that Afghanistan will be even more costly in the USA than Iraq will ever be. At least in Iraq, the people have a history of being learned, cosmopolitan, and urbane.
Well, there's also in Afghanistan a very large history of hospitality, and this is why it's important that we present our presence there as reflecting the wishes of the Afghan population, which it does. If you look at the majority of surveys, most people say, yes, this is a good thing, and it's something we need for peace. And this is also why it is so damaging to the U.S., when we do have things like collateral damage, when the bomb friendly villages or kill friendly Afghans, even in things such as traffic accidents. And in that case, every time we do that, we really need to mitigate it. Otherwise, we're putting ourselves more equivalent with the Soviets. So, yeah, there is a tradition of Afghan xenophobia, but you also have to put that out with one of Afghan hospitality and a willingness to cooperate if they can see there's a better future in it.
Mm-hmm. A couple lines are open if you've been trying to join our conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Isby is our guest. He's the author of several books on Afghanistan and has written many articles. He was a member of the board of directors of the Committee for a Free Afghanistan, a Washington-based attorney, consultant on national security issues, and his books include War in a Distant Country, Afghanistan Invasion and Resistance, War in Afghanistan, the Soviet Empire at High Tide, and Russia's War in Afghanistan. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And we're also talking about this news, which for the past couple days has come from Iran. Iran test firing more long-range missiles last night in a second round of exercises, showing that the country could defend itself against any attack by the United States or Israel, according to state television reports from Tehran. Our next call is Jim from Milwaukee. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Regarding Afghanistan and Iran, you know, I think we're good at breaking it, and we're good at owning it, but we're not good at fixing it. And, you know, I just want people to consider the cost of these wars to our society, not to mention to the people that they're being inflicted on. You know, the cost of the wars are now being currently used. The deficit that we have is being used by people like Ryan and Sensenbringer to justify cuts in domestic programs like the entitlements. And yet no conservative, you know, has been able to come on and justify how we can secure the border, the very rugged border of Afghanistan with the troops that we have, nor can they give us any answer about how they're going to deal with the heroin problem. And then the same thing with Iran. If this thing opens up and we have an engagement with Iran, again, it's just going to destroy our economy in terms of the price of oil. Beyond that also, I'd like people to look at the idea that part of the con game that justifies American actions in foreign policy is to dehumanize the person that that we want to attack, whether it be the Koreans or the Iraqis or the Iranians or anybody else. They're always subhuman. They can't think and reason like we do, and therefore, of course, they would commit an entire nation to suicide, according to the conservative con manipulative thinking. And I don't think that makes sense.
David.
Well, I mean, certainly it's a very good problem. In the long term, there really is going to be no alternative to create a viable government in Afghanistan. Otherwise, if you don't have a viable government, you either create breeding grounds for terrorism, which you saw in Afghanistan before 2001, and you currently see in parts of Pakistan, and things such as heroin cultivation. Now, what you need to the only place you can grow massive amounts of opium poppy are in places without effective governance. And in a globalized economy, the heroin business seeks out the least stable place. That's why Afghanistan has, believe it or not, driven the famous Golden Triangle out of business. And simply because Afghanistan is the least stable and governable place right now. And it's going to, and the reason why, unfortunately, in American commitment is going to be needed for the foreseeable future is to create an indigenous capability to deal with threats such as those.
Do you want to respond, Jim?
Well, just that, you know, it seems to me that the real, if you're talking about terrorist threats to Israel, the thought that I had is that the greatest threat is going to come to Israel with somebody, an individual with a suitcase that walks in. I just don't think that the Iranians are crazy enough to, unless they are attacked first, that they're going to ever make a first strike in Israel, and Israel has the capacity to wipe them out anyhow as well as we do.
Hmm. What do you think of that, David?
Well, certainly the Israelis have experience of that sort of threats, but as we were just saying about the limitations of intelligence. Yeah, nothing is harder to get right than intentions. If you know, we get things which are even objectively findable, you know, such as the presence or absence of WMD, if you get, people get that wrong all the time. So, yeah, you don't want to bet a whole lot on getting the intentions right.
But can you imagine Iran making the first strike?
Yeah, people can do things wrong. It's like doing the during the Cold War, when people used to think of scenarios in which either the Soviets would indeed feel compelled to do it. And the question being, you know, yes, if you're creative enough, you can come up with a scenario. But as long as that capability is there, as it was for the Soviets during the Cold War, you have to take it as a serious threat. In the Cold War, you had a established system of deterrence, which here you have no guarantee would adhere.
We'll take more phone calls in just one moment, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. There's so many news developments all over the place today that we thought we would talk about both Iran and Afghanistan. David Isby is our guest, author of several books on Afghanistan, and has written or edited a number of books and articles on national security. 800-486-8655 is the number, or you can send an email if you'd like, and that address is talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. Thanks for your call, Jim, from Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At the second hour of our program today, Michael Dobbs will be joining us. He's a reporter for the Washington Post and author of 1 Minute to Midnight, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro on the Brink of Nuclear War. Most of the books centers on October 27, called Black Saturday, 1962, the darkest day of the Cold War. On that day, a Soviet missile team in Cuba shot down a U-2, killing its pilot. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended immediate military retaliation. Castro sent Khrushchev a wildly emotional letter saying that he was facing an imminent American invasion, and Khrushchev sent a second letter to Kennedy, far tougher than the earlier one. That night, men in Washington went to sleep, not knowing if they would awake in the morning, and the wives debated whether to stay in Washington with their husbands or go to safer rural hideaways. Almost all stayed, including Jackie Kennedy. It's a fascinating book, and we will talk about that hour number two. Back to your phone calls now, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. David Isby is our guest, and we go next to Taylor from Wales. Hi, Taylor.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question pertaining to the border security between Afghanistan and Pakistan and what can really be done from an American standpoint and maybe from a Pakistani standpoint to control the border regions. And I'll take the call offline.
That's certainly a very difficult point. The border region, most of it is not supervised or even capable. There are a limited number of crossing points at places where commercial trade goes back, but in part because the Afghans' national economy was a casualty of the war that raged from 1978 to 2001, Afghanistan is economically dependent on the Pakistani economy, especially in its south and east. So you certainly can't cut off trade. This also makes it different to put in place military solutions, such as an interdiction campaign. Even if you were able to militarily target people coming into the country, insurgents, and use aircraft or UAVs against them, you have to be very carefully, otherwise you're going to just get too many returning fruit trucks blown up.
Let's go to an email. Tom from Wausau. We're supposed to be in Afghanistan for the sole purpose of finding bin Laden. What else are we doing there? Is it not supposed to be turned, this is not supposed to be turned into another Iraq. We have not any other strategic reason to be there.
Oh, I think there's very much. I think we saw that if we had a national strategy of largely ignoring Afghanistan under the first Bush and Clinton administrations, and that helped give us 9/11. And the question being, and if we can't show the world that we and the world community aren't capable of helping a Islamic nation get their act together after they have been devastated largely by actions of outsiders, that's not going to also go over very well. So I think rather than just get bin Laden and leave, if we do again disengage from Afghanistan, you're going to see not only great suffering from the Afghans, but regional instability that is going to affect the United States, Britain, and the region, as well as the regions that Afghanistan borders.
Steve from Wauwatosa, hi.
Hello.
Hi.
My interest, I'm not sure how this all works out in the long term, but I too think that we should take threats seriously, but my concern is what you do with that information or that concern. And my sense is that American presence in the Middle East and various places actually often has the effect of marginalizing moderate groups within the countries that might actually make progress on their own. Iran is a great example of that, where there's actually a large population of moderate Iranians who now have more trouble getting their voice heard within their own country because American blustering and saber-rattling has made the more extreme groups in Iran take a higher profile, more people, more average citizens in Iran, are afraid of America, and so it actually makes the situation worse.
David.
Yeah, and this is indeed, it's very hard to say who I won play with. And indeed, in the country, even, yes, there are moderates, but even the more moderate people tend to be nationalists and people who would like to live in a democracy in Iran realize that in a dangerous world, you need weapons. And this might include nuclear weapons. So it's very hard to say only the bad guys want nuclear. That's difficult. It's not just only the bad guys and the evil religious conservatives look favorably on nuclear weapons in Iran. It is a much there's much broader support for them. No one takes good polls in Afghanistan, but people do in Iran. People do take good polls in Afghanistan, but I suspect the nuclear program might have fairly broad support.
And thank you very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. We have one line open for you to join this conversation. George is next from Madeline Island. Hi, George.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for this presentation. Thank you for being here, David. I think it's important that we try and understand the perspective of the people we're talking about. Understanding this perspective of Jews and the Holocaust led to the formation of Israel. We also need to understand the perspective of the Iranians, whose democratic elected government in the early 1950s was overthrown by a plot of British and American oil people who did not want their oil nationalized. That led to the Shah, torture and murder of many Iranian citizens, and the overthrow of a democracy. They don't forget that. That lives in the hearts of the people, and we need to keep that history in mind. What's your comment on that?
Well, certainly no administration starts de novo, and I don't think there's certainly U.S.-Iranian relationship dating back to the Shah has not been a good one, and if there had been opportunities to do better things, well, neither this administration nor its predecessor was able to grasp them, and I suspect after seeing how Iranian issues helped bring the Carter presidency to its end and clouded the Reagan second term, very few people in American politics are willing to invest capital that anything good is coming out of Tehran. Now, this is for the Afghans. By the way, the Afghans who desperately want good relations with both Iran and the United States, indeed have to have good relations with both Iran and the United States, this puts them in a terrible spot because they don't want to see, they more than just about anyone else don't want to see a conflict.
Thank you.
Thanks, George, for your call. And let's go to Saeed from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning, Kathy. Thank you very much for taking my call. And if I could just make a brief comment in response to what George was saying, the coup that led to the ouster of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, it will be interesting for everybody to know that the political descendants of the supporters of Mossadegh, the Iranian National Front, are the most pro-Western and pro-democracy forces in Iranian internal politics today. So so though that memory is present in the Iranian consciousness, also is the memory of the tyranny under which they live and the brutality with which this government has dealt with any aspirations of the Iranian people for self-governance. And to assume that this government that's in power now is in any shape, way, or form a democratically elected and representative of the wishes of the Iranian people is absolute false. And my own comment that I was calling to say is that as we devise and think about policy towards Iran, there's a huge tendency to treat it as a black box, totally disregarding the almost 30 years of history that we have on the behavior of the Khomeinis in Iran. And in 30 years that I've been an observer of this of the Khomeinis and how they have conducted themselves vis-a-vis internal and external conflicts, I challenge anyone to call in and give me a single example of how the Islamic Republic resolved a dispute through negotiated settlement. there is none. For many who advocate negotiation or detente with the Ayatollahs are closing their eyes and burying their hands in the heads in the sand when they discount the mischief that this regime is capable of if they were to acquire nuclear weapons. I don't fear that they would use nuclear weapons, but I fear that their possession of nuclear weapons by the Iranian regime will substantially diminish the range of options available to the West in responding to Iran's regional threats. And
what do you see as those range of options, Saeed?
The range of options is some combination of force and negotiation that work best when they apply together. But I guarantee you, on Wisconsin Public Radio a couple of days ago, there was a speaker that said Iran would fear the possession of nuclear weapons by Iran is no big deal because if they used it, we would annihilate 15 million people that live in Tehran with a retaliatory strike. Well, I assure you, no American president. I hope that no American president would sacrifice 15 million innocent lives of Tehranians because the regime, the tyrannic regime in Iran, just send its forces across the border into Iraq or into Kuwait. If the current oil prices give no one a pause for concern, if and when Iran controls 70% of the world's known oil reserves, when they control Iraq and Saudi Arabia, $200 a barrel will look back to that as the good days. And if the world economic order is going to be substantially influenced, this is the problem. And the way that the Iranians have succeeded in the Iranian regime has succeeded in its interactions, diplomatic and otherwise, against the West, is because we have continuously underestimated them, and we have not treated this as the existential and significant threat that it is.
David.
Yes, certainly there is a lot there, and even without the nuclear aspects, Iran is going to be playing a role in the energy politics, which are becoming increasingly important with the rising price of energy and the increasing demands of rising powers such as China and India. And of course, this is very much a impact directly on Afghanistan. And of course, this is one reason, for example, why Iran is largely very unpopular amongst the Hazara population of Afghanistan, even though as Shias, they might be expected to be pro-Iran, and indeed they do revere many Shia religious figures. But the Iranian backing creation of a civil war there in the 1980s has again left a great deal of bitterness against the regime in Tehran. So in Afghanistan, they're very much on a tightrope, and they need good relations with Tehran, but I don't think there's a lot of thinking that it's basically a benign creation.
Thank you, Saeed, very much for your informed comments. He mentioned the wishes of the Iranian people here. Is there a way for us to know what the wishes of the Iranian people are? And if they're not very happy with who's controlling the country, is there a way to sort of stir things up and change the government?
Well, that's always difficult, certainly, to say. In Afghanistan, we are currently able to have in much the country. There has been people like the Asia Society, the CSIS, have done some very good and comprehensive polling on what the people in Afghanistan want. Certainly much harder to say in Iran. The elections in Iran are indeed very far from being full, fair, open, meeting international standards, even though they do have enough participation that you can get some ideas. And things such as street demonstrations, the expressions of sympathy in much of Iran after the 9/11 attacks in the United States, when the Iranians were expressing sympathy with the United States. So again, because there is no one answer, people just have to draw their their views from these indicators and determine which ones are misleading.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's such a tricky time, isn't it, David? It's such a hard time. Don't you think?
Yes, interesting times, as the old curse goes.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
David Isby, he is a Washington-based attorney and a consultant on national security issues. He is the author of 3 books on Afghanistan and many articles, War in a Distant Country, Afghanistan Invasion and Resistance, War in Afghanistan, the Soviet Empire at High Tide, Russia's War in Afghanistan. He's written or edited 20 books and over 350 articles on national security, and he has testified before congressional committees as an independent expert on Afghanistan, frequently appearing in print and electronic media as an expert on national security issues, including CNN, Voice of America, C-SPAN, McNeil Lehrer, the McLaughlin Group, Fox and Friends, and others, and lectures at staff colleges and other institutions in Afghanistan. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and to John Anderson for on-air production and for putting together this program. And thanks to all of you for your many phone calls and emails as well. Some of the emails came in a little late, so I'm sorry we could not get to all of them. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then stay tuned for the next hour. It's going to be fascinating. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.